How's it going? We had fun this morning. I guess it was a little long one for many of you, sorry about that. I'll try not to make them too long, but oh well. Just so you know, because some of you will ask, the time early to him, we came back to be in 1 week. It takes a while to grade these things, and we have to then record the grades, and I actually like to look at them and think about it, and then get the spread all set up before I give it back, because many of you may feel like you got hit by a truck. I'm sort of not doing my job if the exam is such that you don't feel a little bit like you got hit by a truck, because otherwise it's not challenging, so I'm trying to tell you. The mean is often, you know, at 65-ish or 70-ish, so for it to be that low, you definitely got some stuff that many of you didn't get everything, right? So you might feel frustrated. So that said, forget about it now. Don't worry about it. Move on. And we'll hand this thing back probably in a week. I'll count on my TA in a week. And so be it. Okay, so the other thing is, I got an email from my TAs after they did this. I think they knew this was coming. They sort of said when they were grading problem set 4, they picked a problem that they thought was a relatively easy one. It was actually one where you had two boxes sitting on top of one another. And when I look at that problem, I just don't see how you can really do it without sitting there and doing a free body diagram and everything. I guess they felt the same way. It's apparent that a huge fraction of you really didn't do it that way. And it was counted zero if you didn't do it that way, basically. I think that's probably a bit harsh. The TAs were a little surprised when they went through it and realized that a huge fraction of the class were basically getting a 0 for 1. I guess in my mind, I wish they had gone back and just redid that, but they didn't, and it came out the way it is. So I'm just going to give everybody credit for problem set 4 and not worry about it, okay? So, you know, if you were a slacker and didn't really do problem set 4, you just got away with it, okay? So my guess is that's not actually too many of you, so I'm not too worried about it, but I do understand that there's an issue with the grading of that one, so I'm just going to make that issue go away. So you don't need to email me about that one. Even though it's probably going to show up as a 0, because I mean, I have to go into Blackboard. It'll probably take me 45 minutes to change problem set 1 and problem set 4 columns to all 1, okay? And I hope I don't have to keep doing this, but basically, you know, so it may not actually happen. I may wait until I download it to my Excel spreadsheet where I can just set the whole column to 1, or it's trivial. Don't get hung up about it. If in the end I send your grade to you, you know, in the final, at the end of the course, and you see that you got 0 for that one, then let me know about it. Otherwise, don't worry about it. The other thing is, I believe Monday and Tuesday are fall break, right? Yeah. It's pretty awesome. I mean, we saw this really lame one-day thing, and now they've actually given us 2 days. It's almost a real weekend. Okay, so I hope that you all will actually have some fun and be able to relax a little bit. I'll certainly try to post a really massive problem set for you so that you don't get too carried away. And the other thing, though, is it sort of screws up our workshop cycle, which we typically have starting on Mondays. So we're obviously not going to have workshops on Mondays and Tuesdays. If it was just one day, I'd sort of say, if you have a workshop that day, why don't you just go to other workshops? But it's like 2 days, so it's a number section. So that doesn't really make sense. So what I think I'm going to do is to literally change the cycle start for the workshop. So we're going to start a new workshop on Wednesday of next week, and it will continue through the Tuesday of the following week. And that will continue to be the pattern for until something else screws us up. Okay? Any issues, questions, concerns at this point? Okay. So last time we talked about work and energy, and I gave you this, at some level, possibly useless to you, definition of work, the formal definition, but it's sort of the general case. If you have a force on something that may change with time, okay, generally, it could be in any direction, it could change in magnitude, and if something changes its position in the function of time, it may or may not really be correlated, right? I mean, I can exert a force on something and have other forces on it that are forcing it to go a particular way. So it's not necessarily true that this thing's going to go the direction of this particular force. But if I ask, what is the work done by that force on this object? Then that's what it is. Okay, where ds is a little differential piece of this motion that this thing is going on. And you go to the differential piece so that you actually have over that small little bit, you have a specific direction. It might be in a curve, but if I go to a differential amount of it, it looks straight. And over that differential little piece, it's over such a small time, that the force, even though the force may be changing in time, for that moment it will actually not be changing, not have changed. So you can then use the definition of force dotted into distance, which is what I have here over that little ds, and then we sum up all the little ds's along the thing, okay? So that's sort of the general definition. It is likely you will see very little of something where, I mean, it is, certainly I can give you a function. I can demand it as sort of doing an integral, and that could be done. But what is more likely, and the majority of the kinds of things you'll see, is that this movement and the forces will actually be over discrete things. So we did an example where you climb up a cliff, over, and then down a cliff. So you have somebody on a sliding board, and they're on the sliding board, and then they're on the ground or something. So it'll be discrete pieces of it, and you can think of this integral as basically just a sum over those discrete pieces, where you can think about the forces and the distances and the dot product in a reasonable way. So that's typically what we'll see. And so you'll do lots of examples of that. Okay, so we talked about energy in its different forms, and certainly potential energy is the ability where you have the potential to do work, right? Potential is one of these very rich words. So if I lift something up, it has the potential to do something. Right, if you go to a party and you see somebody really good looking, that's potential. Right, so it's sort of a little bit the same thing, right? See, in principle, the idea is that it could happen, right? So that's sort of the thing. And remember that work is basically force times distance. So in physics, I don't know what you mean about potential at a party, but for in physics, it's just force times distance. So energy takes different forms. So one form is associated usually with position or however the system is arranged, which is what gives you this potential to do energy. So it could be the height of the book, it could be the fact that a screen is stretched, it could be where you are relative, so the height of the book, where you are relative to the center of the earth. So we're going to talk about different forms of potential energy through much of the class today. Kinetic energy is another form, and we actually derive the fact that kinetic energy classically in physics we're going to do takes the form of 1/2 mv². So any object at any time in principle has kinetic and potential energy, so you'll have to think about that. So I'm going to come back to that in a moment, but in the spirit of what we did last time, just to remind us, I started the discussion with springs, because the kinds of systems that we will use to study energy flow, we'll use gravitational systems, and part of what we've already done is gravitational systems where we're near the surface of the Earth, for example. So we change the height and you get a potential energy at mgh, so we change in height. springs will also use. The reason that we use gravity and springs is that if I don't introduce friction or something, the energy flows very smoothly between the kinetic energy and the potential energy. And so that's sort of going to be what we'll talk about most of today. But that's partly why we talk a lot about springs and why I'm bringing this up. The other thing is once we're sort of done with the whole spring concept, it turns out that this kind of concept is very useful in a lot of the other things that we'll end up doing in physics, both in 113 and 114. So the idea of a spring, though, is that you can stretch it out like this, or you can compress it, all relative to the natural length that the spring is just basically sitting there happily. Okay? And if you stretch it out, the spring will want to pull you back. If you compress it, the spring is pushing back to where you started. So the spring actually has what we call restoring force. And that restoring force is proportional to the distance that you stretch it or compress it relative to that natural length. So this is the proportionality. We put in a proportionality constant, which basically then specifies the specifics for that spring. K is big if it's a stiff spring. K is not a big number if it's a light spring. That sort of specifies for a change in length, how much you compress or stretch, how much force you actually get. Because force is a vector, we have to have a vector equation for this thing. And we have to quantify the fact that if we pull it this way, the force is back the other way, and if we compress it, the force again wants to return. So we can really do that by putting a minus sign here relative to the difference between x minus x zero. Okay, and this is known as Hooke's law. Very often, when you're looking at a spring problem, I think you can confuse yourself if you get too hung up with this particular form. Okay, usually you're better served by using common sense. If you have a physical problem and you are stretching a ball this way, you should know that the force goes the other way and its magnitude is going to be given by this. Or if I set the natural length as zero, if the problem is defined that way, you may see it sort of in the form of chaos. And when the problem is set up, usually your common sense is what you want to use to dictate the direction, rather than getting too strung out about defining a coordinate system and making sure that you get the sign right here. I think it's very easy to sort of get confused with that. So my recommendation is, generally speaking, sort of use your common sense in the problem at hand to figure out what the direction is, and then deal mostly with the magnitude form of this. Okay? Any questions on the basic idea of spring? So we're going to do a little more with that kind of today. Okay. So we'll come back to that. So I would like to look at energy flow in several examples and think about what we mean when we talk about potential energy. But the other thing is, I want to lay out one of the basic laws of physics. And that is energy as a whole is conserved. What do I mean by that? Anything?
No matter what happens in the system, the amount of energy that is
okay, so no matter what happens in the system, the amount of energy you start with is the same as the amount of energy that you end with. It could change form. Alright, so I think that said pretty well. That is true for an isolated system. You can think your way through it in many instances, okay? If I have a conservative force and I move a book, I have changed its position. We have already calculated how potential energy changes position. If I were to let it go, it goes back down to that same height. That energy is all converted into kinetic energy. And you can, the energy flow between the kinetic and potential, or the amount of work that I put in, all will make clean sense, okay? The problems are not always so straightforward. If I throw friction into the problem, there may be some ill-defined part to this that's hard to do. When we get to momentum conservation, we're going to be looking at what happens when you shoot a bullet into a block of wood, for example. And you'll have a kinetic energy of the bullet, you'll have a kinetic energy of this block of wood and bullet when it's moving. And many of you will be tempted to basically use energy conservation there. But you're missing a piece, because when the bullet goes into the wood, it loses a lot of energy in ways that we know nothing about, friction and heat and sound and all this other crap. So energy conservation for that system, for you and this problem, is not a useful concept. We'll end up using momentum conservation, and that will work. But so the fact is, energy is conserved. It does not mean that it will always make sense in the problem to pull it out and create a formula out of it. Okay, so you have to learn when it's appropriate to use energy conservation and when it's not. But this, as a whole, is a very fundamental law of physics, and it certainly takes strange forms. Okay, one of Einstein's big breakthroughs in relativity was the realization that something with mass, that mass is actually just a form of energy. Okay, so it's a very bizarre sort of thing that we don't typically think about. So energy anyway takes many forms, and energy as a whole is conserved, and sometimes that's a very useful constraint for you to analyze. But mathematically, a way to say it is that some of the energy of things in the initial state is equal to the sum of the energy of things in the final state. And this, then, is the sum of the kinetic energy and the potential energy for everything in the system. All right, so I might have something that's going very fast up a hill, and the initial state of the energy is you have a kinetic energy but not much potential energy, and when it gets up to the hill, it's lost all its kinetic energy, you have a lot more potential energy. So this is sort of the sum of the kinetic and potential energy, but you can also have things happening. So you can have work that's done. Somebody can push it up the hill, you can have it losing energy to friction. Sometimes you can quantify this, but basically, one way to write energy conservation that you'll see in some books and things is that the work done, and so this is often something that's not, we would say it's non-conservative, so this might be done to, I can't spell and talk at the same time. This might be something like friction, or it might be the hand of God coming and moving the ball or whatever in the problem. That work done is equal to the change in kinetic energy plus the change in the potential energy. Or sometimes this might be written as the change in K plus the change in U. U is sometimes a symbol for potential energy. So very often you'll see energy conservation basically written in some form like this. And you'll be tempted, if you're one of these people that really likes to just pull out an equation and use it without thinking very hard, you'll be tempted to really pull out this equation. And it is a true equation. But I actually find, again, sometimes you're very likely to end up making mistakes if you're really trying to get the signs right in all this. Because remember, work can come in positive and negative, and so you have to be thinking about what works on what. And what, I mean, so this can be confusing. So I caution you if you're going to jump into the equation world. I actually have liked the, I prefer to sort of think my way through the energy flow Think of it as a quantity. Think about what you start with and where the energy goes and where energy comes from. And so I tend to sort of use this formula where I ask what's going on in the problem. So we'll do the problem. I'll try to lead you through the way I think through it. But be a little cautious about just pulling out the equation. But you'll certainly see it written that way. So let's look at one example. I mean, we did one thing in the class, and these slides happen to be prepared already, so I'm just going to use them. I'll post them. So we did this pendulum problem, and we're not trying to be obnoxious calling it a simple pendulum. Okay, we actually need this a very definite definition. When people talk about a simple pendulum, they basically mean you've got a mass with a massless string. And so all you really have is this mass moving. And very often, really, you want to talk about something that moves with relatively small angles, but we're going to keep the angle big right now so we can see what's going on. Last class we had basically this pendulum, and I think it was John, right? John was standing here, put this up near his nose, and then let it go. And so the pendulum swings over to the other side. And we use conservation of energy in the fact that gravity is a conservative force. So the total energy that we have at any given point is going to be the sum of the kinetic energy, 1/2 mv², plus the sum of the height above some arbitrary point. So potential energy is this funny thing. What we use in these problems, what's important, are changes in energy. And you have the freedom to choose where your zero is for your coordinate system. So what generally is true, for example, in your life, is it's not so much your absolute height or sea level that's so important to you. What's actually important to your everyday life is what are the changes in your height above sea level. So are you going to get tired going up the stairs in your dorm? It has to do with the change, not the fact that the whole thing is at some set height above sea level. So energy is sort of the same way. Typically, these problems that are really important are the changes in the energy, not the absolute energy. So you have the freedom to, say, choose the height of the floor, for example, and then we look at the height above that. And that's what we have here. So given that we define life at zero at a certain point, then we can define the potential energy as such. If I were to change for y equals zero, the potential energy absolutely would change, but the changes in potential energy as I go through the problem won't change. So it's an arbitrary choice. So we start out, we bring the pendulum up to its highest point on one side, and at that point it's not moving. V is equal to zero, so all of the energy is just mg times its height, which I call h1. Then you let the pendulum go, and at the bottom, it's now moved to the point where its height is now zero. So its potential energy is zero, and yet all of its total energy has now converted into kinetic energy. So we know that the initial potential energy that we have is now equal to the kinetic energy at the bottom. So we can calculate the velocity at this point if we know the height. And this is assuming that gravity is a conservative force. Because I haven't thrown any friction or something that you don't understand. Okay? So potential energy converts to kinetic energy, and then the ball rises, goes to the other side, and all of its potential and kinetic energy of motion is converted back to potential energy, and because gravity is a conservative force, all of that flows all the way back into potential energy. So that means this height, mgy, has to be exactly the same as the height on the other side. And then all of that reverses coming back, which is how we know that if you have the ball up against your nose and you let it go, when it comes back, in a perfect system, it's just going to come back and touch your nose. Okay? And you, when we did the demo, you noticed that it didn't quite get even that far because we lost a little bit of energy to friction and air friction and things that we really weren't quantifying. But if we did it in a vacuum with a perfect frictionless sort of joint up at the top, then it would literally have come back and just touched his nose. Okay? Alright, so this is really what we mean by a conservative force, is that this energy, the energy in this enclosed system is constant. If I don't tell you that something else is involved. So okay, so this is what we call the generalized work energy theorem. It's basically what I told you a minute ago. This is the non-conservative work. That is, if I, as part of the problem, I'm putting work into the pendulum, or if there's friction involved, then it would be a non-conservative amount of work. And that will then change the amount of kinetic energy or the amount of potential energy in the problem. And at the same time, the kinetic and potential might be flowing from one to the other. So one way of saying we have a conservative system is the fact that we don't have anything going on here. So if it's just a spring, if it's just a pendulum and all you have are changes in gravity, I don't have friction involved, then you'll be able to look at the flow from kinetic energy to potential energy and everything. Okay. So anyway, let's look at a problem. Let's imagine we have a block that's on an inclined plane, and the block starts out at height d up above the inclined plane. And so the block then comes down, and assume that this transition is smooth, even though it looks like it's not going to be. And then we have a straight line here with a coefficient of kinetic friction mu sub k. And the question is, if I have a height d here, how far along this floor will the block slide, given mu sub k? All right? And this is then an energy conservation and work problem. So the first thing to do, sort of like when you're sitting down to do Newton's law problems, the first thing I'd like you to do is get some idea of how things move, you know, what's going on. So now, for these kinds of problems, I want you to think about what's going on with the energy flow. This thing is high, so its energy is really the potential energy of its position here. So it's got all potential energy. It's not currently moving. Its velocity is zero, so there is no kinetic energy. You then let it go. It's sliding down a frictionless plane here, so all of its potential energy as it slides gets converted into kinetic energy. So I'm going to have at the bottom 1/2 mv squared in kinetic energy that's equal to mg times d. Right, which is the amount of potential energy it has up here. So you have an entire conversion at that point. Now it's sliding along the floor, and you have so much kinetic energy there, the potential energy is now zero if we define this as the zero to height. And now it slides along the floor, and basically it's going to lose energy to the floor. It's going to lose energy to the friction. Or a way to think about it is the floor is doing work on this block by slowing it down as it goes. Friction, generally, the energy gets converted into heat. And if you don't believe me, you just take your hands and do this a little bit. Right? It just gets hot. Okay? And this whole equivalence between work and energy was initially demonstrated by, I want to say Lord Kelvin. You may know. Way back when, the guy took a cannon, and they used to literally have to bore the hole out of the cannon, right? And so they would do this in water because it would get hot. And they actually quantified the change in the temperature of the water for the amount of physical work that they were doing in this sort of thing, and actually found this equivalence between mechanical energy and thermal energy. So you probably had to deal with that a lot in chemistry. At any rate, so what literally is happening is the block the floor does work on the block, and literally the kinetic energy gets converted to heat as it slides across the floor. So, to solve the problem, we calculate how much kinetic energy we have here, which we know has to be mgd, okay? And then that kinetic energy has to be converted into the amount of work it takes to stop it. The work is equal to the energy. So we will have, remember that the force here is going to be the normal force times mu sub k. This thing isn't crashing through the floor or flying, so I know the normal force is equal to mg for the block on the floor. So mg times mu sub k is going to be the magnitude of the work done on this object times the distance. The work is force times distance. The force is the force of friction. So if we step through that, so the change in potential energy is this mgd. I know that goes to the kinetic energy, 1/2 mv squared, which then goes back into work. I can sort of skip the whole kinetic energy part. Because it's sort of this intermediate part conceptually, but it doesn't really matter because it's this amount of energy that's getting converted to that much work. So you can take the change in potential energy is equal to mu sub k mgx. Now, I even forget where I pulled these slides up. At some point I had to present it for somebody else, or somebody else made them, et cetera. Anyway, I ended up with these slides and thought it was more efficient to do this than to draw it all. But you'll note that whoever did it was really hung up on using this formula. And they start pulling all these minus signs. So that's a little bit what I mean. I actually don't like that because it's really easy to get twisted in a knot and get a sign wrong and then you're screwed. Just think about energy flow. I have total energy here of mgd because that's what it is, right? That's the potential energy, it's not moving. In the end, that gets converted into friction energy, or, you know, work that's done here. What is that? It's going to be the force of friction times the distance. I can set those equal to each other, which basically is what you do here, but when they do it, they end up with these minus signs, and I can't really think my way through either of those minus signs. So I end up just thinking about magnitude of energy flowing into that. And so I say mgd is equal to mu sub k mg, which is the force of friction times the distance it goes. That's how I think about it. Okay? So anyway, you solve them for x. Any questions on that? So I actually forget how your particular book will do it. Books tend to sort of like to do the formulas, so they like to do this work non-conservative, the change in U plus change in K. I just find that in the end is often very confusing when you're practically facing the problem. So try to think about just using energy flow. If you really want to try to use the formula, then do so. But you really have to watch your signs and think about it. I mean, certainly you can do it that way. Yeah, be very careful. Okay, so what I want to do now is to come back to the spring. Because we've talked a little bit about how the spring force works, but what I'd like to do now is to examine how energy works in spring. Energy basically is a measure of work done. So what I'd like to do is to measure how is energy stored in the spring as it's stretched or compressed. So a way to do that is to consider how much work do I have to actually do the stretching or the compressing. Because in the end, when I do work, I am giving the spring energy, potential energy. That's what happens. If I exert a force through a distance, I stretch it out. Now it has the potential to do work or exert a force or a discipline. So I want to start out with a string. And let's say that it has a natural length at zero, okay? And I'm going to give it an arbitrary length here, which I call x1, and another arbitrary length here called x2. And what I'd like to do is to just look at how the energy in the spring changes as I move from x1 to x2. What is the work done to the spring or on the spring to move it from x1 to x2? Okay. So now we come back to our definition. The work done on the spring is going to be the integral of moving the spring from position x1 to position x2 of the force that I have to exert on the spring in order to do that, dotted into ds, because that's the general rule that we have. But in this case, ds is just really a dx moving along. So you can imagine now summing this motion up as a bunch of little ds's along this x-coordinate, okay? So this ds is really a dx. The force that I have to use on the spring in order to stretch it, quite literally, is a force where I'm pulling it this way, because I'm stretching it out. So F is this way. So F and DS are in the same direction, so the dot product becomes just F times DS. From x1 to x2. DS is, it's a differential along the x direction, so I can also just call it DX with no loss of generality here. So this one is in this particular problem. So you think of it that way. F, then it is true that I could really yank the string, I could accelerate it or something, but then I don't know what I'm doing. I mean, that becomes arbitrarily complicated. So the way to think about it is I slowly stretch the string so that at any given point it's not actually accelerating, because then I actually know what's going on with the force. I know that at any given point, the spring is pulling back with k x minus x zero in magnitude, which means the force I exert the other direction has to be equal to that, right? That way you can have them move with no acceleration. So that means that when I'm evaluating the work, the force that I'm using on the spring in order to slowly stretch it out is going to be just kx minus x. Right. For simplicity, we can just define x0 to be 0 for our x-axis. So if we do that, we get this from x1 to x2 of kx dx. The integral of kx, the k constant pulls out, the integral of x is x squared over 2. So this whole thing becomes 1/2 k x2 minus x1. You okay? All right, so the work done is equal to, there's no kinetic energy involved in this because we're sort of just moving incrementally slower. So the work done is equal to the potential energy at the end minus the potential energy at the start. And this will make sense if we define that the potential energy stored in the spring is equal to 1/2 kx squared, where this x is the distance from the natural length. That x is represents the degree to which it stretched or compressed. Yeah.
Where you wrote 1/2 kx squared,
yes, it should be x squared. Thank you. Okay, so what this means is if I define a height in a certain problem and I lift the book up, I can define its potential energy as mgh. I mean, we've been doing that. In the same way, if I have a spring, depending on the position of the spring in the problem, there's a certain amount of energy stored in the spring. That amount of energy is 1/2 kx squared, where x is the degree to which it's stretched or the degree to which it's compressed. Okay? And there's complete symmetry on the stretching and the compressing. Because we're not talking extremes. Yeah, if I compress it all the way into the wall, things change. So we don't do that. Okay, any questions? All right, so it turns out that this is very important. We use it all the time. So the potential energy of the spring goes as 1/2 kx squared. So I'll put that there. All right, so let's do an example problem so we get some idea of how to play the spring. Let's imagine that I have a spring which I hang from the ceiling, and when I do, it just sits there, and so I have some sort of position here, and I'll define this then as its natural length. And let's say that we now take a fish and hook it to the end of the spring and slowly lower. And when we do that, until it's just hanging there, when we do that, we're going to find that this fish stretches the spring distance D. So all of this might be written in the problem so far. So then the question is, if I have the situation where I hang the fish on the string but I have the string right up at its natural length here, and instead of slowly lowering the fish, I just let it go. Right? So what's going to happen is the spring is at its natural length. I let the fish go, the fish is going to go like that, right? It's going to go down. And so then the problem is how low does the fish go when you let it go? So you let it go And of course, the fish goes flying down here and then starts to come back up because of the spring. And so really the question is, the mouth of the fish, you know, goes to what height? All right? And let us suppose that I give you the fish mass of him. So that's basically the top of all the gifts. So I haven't told you what the spring problem is. Okay? So in the first part, let's ask what's going on with the fish. We've let it down, and now it's stable at that bottom point. So in order for it to be stable, I know that the sum of the forces is equal to zero. Because the fish is no longer moving. What is the force down? I know I have mg down. And then I have the force of the spring up. Those are the only two forces on the fish. So the sum of the forces is equal to zero. That means the force on the, of the spring upward is equal to mg down. What's the force of the spring? It's going to be k, or whatever it is, times this distance d. Which means if I give you d in the problem and I give you the mass, we've just solved for k. And that's very typical for sort of spring problems. You may be given sort of two situations in the same problem. And one of those situations is going to have some weird wording, like when something is hung on the spring and it's held still in such and such a position. That one piece is really there to give you information to calculate the spring constant. And then there'll be the second piece, which is sort of the more dynamic part of the problem, given that spring constant, whatever else is going on. So in this case, this piece gives you the spring constant, okay? And now we know how strong the spring is. And now we can come over here and use this, okay? So you might say, well, and if I gave this problem to you on an exam, sorry, I don't mean to bring up raw thoughts, put salt in the wound. But if I were to have an exam problem right now and I just gave it to you, many of you would look at this and you would go, oh, okay, I have a 1/2 kx up, or I have kx up and I have mg down, and you sort of try to use constant acceleration equations to solve it. But that doesn't work. Because note that the fish starting out has nothing but the gravity force on it initially. As it stretches the spring force increases as it stretches, getting stronger and stronger until it stops. So that force is not constant, which means it's not constant acceleration, which means those four equations you're used to are useless. Okay? So this becomes a harder problem. We could, in principle, do an integral to this. But in fact, we just did in the last stage. We now understand how the potential energy changes as a function of time, as a function of stretching. So we can use energy conservation here rather than try to work our way through the kinematics. And this is one of the reasons energy conservation is so useful. Okay. So if you think about it, if we define this as h equals zero, if you want, when the fish sinks down to this point, then I have a change in potential energy equal to mg times however much I've stretched it. I don't know what I'm trying to type up, what a variable I want to use for. And we have, that's a change in the gravitational potential energy. We also have a change in the spring potential energy, which is 1/2 k h squared, where h is this distance that I go. So I could go to that formula, work non-conservative, of which there's none in this problem, is equal to the change in kinetic energy plus the change in potential energy. Well, I start with this thing at V equals zero, it ends at V equals zero, so the kinetic energy is irrelevant. So it becomes just the change in the potential energy. And you can then worry about the signs. And in fact, if you think about it, you have more potential energy here for gravity than you do here, because it's falling. And you have zero potential energy in the spring, which then becomes non-zero as you stretch it more. So it's sort of clear that you've got energy from gravity, kinetic potential energy from gravity being converted into potential energy of the spring. And so you can try to get those signs right and just use the formula, or you can just stop and think about it for a moment. What's happening? I have so much energy stored in gravity, gravitational potential energy. As I drop it, that gets converted into potential energy of the spring and stretches it. Therefore, I know that mgh is equal to 1/2 k. In this case, I'm using h as the degree to which it's been stretched here. So that'd be 1/2 k h squared. So I can take that and this. Substitute in for k. All right, one of the h's cancels out, the mg's cancel, and I get that h is equal to 2d. So that would be the answer to the problem. Any questions on how to think your way through something like that? Case, again, the force is going to be changing as the spring is released, as the spring lets rise, it's pushing the block. The other thing to note is the spring is only in contact with the block until it reaches this point. The block and the spring keep moving, but if the block is not tied to the spring, the block separates from the spring when the spring reaches that natural length point. How do I know that? The moment the spring is stretched beyond this point, there's a force pulling it back. So it has an acceleration backwards, so it slows down. Okay? The block just keeps going. Now the truth is that the friction is so massive that the block literally doesn't keep going, then the spring never loses contact. But you'll find problems where you're going to have to sort of, it's going to give you something similar to this, and it won't really spell this out. But basically, you let the spring go, and you're going to be wondering, okay, how fast is this block going? And the only way you know is to know that the spring converts all of its potential energy into the kinetic energy of that block. But it doesn't push it any further, because the spring and the block lose contact right at that point. And it will, you do have to pay attention as to whether it's actually attached to the spring or not. This is a totally different problem if this thing is literally attached to the spring. Alright, so anyway, you release the block. So, well, if you think your way through it, again, we have the potential energy stored in the spring that gets converted into kinetic energy, so the thing is moving very fast, but it now loses all of its energy to the work done by the floor due to the force of friction. So, again, I can take the potential energy of the spring and set it equal to how much work was done by the force of friction. So the thing's going to move, you know, some distance, which is this 1 meter. So I know how far it goes. I know the mass of the block, so I can figure out what the force of friction is with the use of K in there, and I'm trying to determine the use of K. So the potential energy of the spring is 1/2 times K of the spring, which I should have given you. It's in the problem. Meter. So you're given the spring constant. So we have 1/2 k x squared for this initial spring. Is equal to the work done by friction, which is going to be the use of k times the normal force times the distance that you go. Right. So this then, the problem we said was 0.2 meters, and D here we said was 1 meter. Use of K is what you're trying to find. K you're given is 100 newtons per meter, and the normal force, because this thing's on the floor and you have mg down, normal up, and it's not flying or crashing through the floor, so you know that m is equal to mg. So the normal here is mg. Right. So now you can plug all your various pieces in. And if you solve for uk, algebraically, with the symbols in here, you get kx squared over 2 mg d. And if you plug in the numbers, I think when I did that, I found the use of k is equal to 0.41. Okay? So there are a couple of other things I want to talk to you about energy. The one sort of arbitrary definition that we're going to end up using a lot, and that is if we consider how the energy is flowing as a function of time, we have the definition of something which we call power. So power is the change in work per change in time, or change in work would be the change in energy of the system as a function of time. We can go to instantaneous power, so generally we look at it this way, is dW over dt. This is in joules per second, and we've defined joules per second as something which we call a watt. So that's the unit of power in MKS. So a 100-watt light bulb is something which converts 100 joules of energy into heat and light per second. Okay? So this is important, and you'll just need to use it. And I'm throwing it here sort of for completeness. Forces are sort of complex, and sometimes it's easier to think your way through energy in a system than it is to think your way through forces. So what I'd like to do is to examine for a moment how the force and the variation of the energy in the system are related. In particular, the potential energy. So we've defined work as force times distance, in essence, right? And if we go to some differential limit, and we only move at a tiny little distance, say a dx, dw is equal to the force times dx, if I don't worry about direction too long. Okay? So if you think about that, this change in the work I do to the system, is also, it's really the change in the potential energy of the system. So I take a string and I move it out of dx. I have converted, I've given a little bit of different potential energy to the string. And we generally use the symbol U for potential energy. So this is equal to F times dx. So if I look at this and I pull the dx to the other side, the change in the potential energy of the system is proportional to the force in that direction for whatever system I'm talking about. So if I take a string, I'm talking about x, and I exert a force in the x direction, I'll change the potential energy because I'm doing work to the system. So let's consider a spring. For a spring, I know that the potential energy as a function of x is 1/2 kx². The derivative of the potential energy with respect to x is equal to just kx. But that is also the force that you have for a string, where x is the distance from the natural length. So you can draw, for example, the position x and look at how the potential energy varies as a function of x. And we see that it depends on x². So if we wanted to draw the potential energy in a spring, how it depends on how the spring is compressed or stretched, We have a function. It's a parabola. It's supposed to cross the zero here. 1/2 k x squared. And the force at any given position is equal to the slope of this energy function, and where you are. Right, because the slope is the derivative. So what this means is I can have a very complicated system, and if I can just understand how the energy of the system varies with some position or whatever, for free I get the force as well as a function of position. So in chemistry, for example, very often you'll be talking about things, but what are you going to look at when somebody is describing a van der Waals force to you? What do you usually see? You don't usually see a graph of the force as a function of time or a function of position of the two chemicals from each other. You normally see a graph of the potential energy of the system as a function of distance. Okay, so this gives you the sort of way to translate from one to the other. So there's a general rule here, which is that the force in some direction S is equal to minus the derivative of the potential along that direction. The straight derivative here gives you kx. The slope here is very positive. Now when I pull the spring out, the force is not positive. It's not continuing to stretch the spring, okay? It's actually the other direction. So that's why I know that I have to throw in a minus sign. So in fact, when I'm looking at the relationship between energy and position, it's basically minus this is equal to the force. So this is a general rule. S here represents any given direction. This is actually a three-dimensional thing. So you could do this with partial derivatives and the whole three-dimensional thing. But in general, we're only going to look at single-dimensional things. So I'm going to give this to you with just one-dimensional derivative here. So if it's a spring, and the spring is being stretched and compressed along x, S is then x. If this is a gravitational problem, which we'll do in a moment, and I'm moving something in and out in the radius from, say, the center of the planet, then this would be in the r direction, okay? So that's why I'm sort of generic variable s. But this is then the relationship between the potential energy function of a system and the force at a given position, what the force function is. I think we're all brain dead today, right now, which is fine. Well, it is what it is. So the next thing I want to get into is to look at gravitation and gravitational potential energy in a bit more detail. And I don't want to take the time to do that now, so I'll do that a week from now, because back to TJ if you don't. Okay? So I hope you all have a wonderful long weekend. And I'll try to post the problem.